There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hello, welcome to the latest episode of The Other Hand podcast. Chris, we're doing something slightly different today. We've invited a guest on to the podcast to get her views on the world. And our guest is Sarah Carey, who is a columnist with the Irish Independent, somebody I know with a good few years, I think, at this stage, Sarah. So welcome and thank you very much for agreeing to contribute. I think the reason why both of us reached out to you was because of the very powerful piece you wrote in the Irish Independent recently in the aftermath of the referenda. It was a strong piece. It was an angry analysis, I guess, on behalf of mothers. And there's a couple of quotes that I'd like to pick out that really struck me. One was, your parting comment was, "I have a womb that grew three babies, and I have breasts that made milk to feed them. I am a miracle of nature. I am a mother. I am a woman. Hear me roar." Okay. And the second piece was, "The far right has not broken through. The center has not fallen. It is the political establishment that has fallen into the abyss. I haven't left Fine Gael, but Fine Gael has left me." Second part there certainly resonated with me. I voted no in both referenda. Okay, I put my hand up and say that first and foremost. And I remember on the Friday evening when I went up to vote, I met a lot of people voting, people I knew. And to a person, they were all voting no. And it certainly struck me then that this referendum was lost from a government perspective. But anyway, and I guess the second thing I would have in common with you, as Chris knows, and I've often expressed it in this podcast, you know, I am a traditional Fine Gael voter. I voted Fine Gael all my life, apart from a couple of elections where I voted Progressive Democrat based on policies. Okay. Shame on me. But anyway, that's where I am. So, first, Sarah, could just ask you about that piece you wrote in the aftermath of the referenda.
Before you answer this, Sarah, can I just say congratulations? Because a lot of people are giving you credit for Leo's demise as a result of that very article.
Yeah, I did get a lot of funny texts, Chris, saying, you know, that Leo's resignation was therefore all my fault. And obviously that's entertaining, but I'm sure an exaggeration. But I think it did reflect a lot of the disgruntlement within the centre and within traditional Fine Gael voters who might not have been voicing it publicly, you know, particularly within the parliamentary party, but had really had enough. And I think the referendum was really a straw that broke the camel's back, that it wasn't a one-off, an event on its own, but there had been a lot of policy shifts over the last 5 years that were making people feel more and more and more and more alienated. But because of the public discourse and any disagreement is labelled as far right, people were feeling, including myself, that you couldn't give voice to your concerns about anything. And in fact, I just looked back before I joined the podcast on a piece I wrote back in January, in which I said that the government were at that point already trying to characterize people who intended voting no as being far right. And I said, look, people might be afraid to speak up, but they get to vote in secret and a protest vote beckons. So in relation to the referendum specifically, I think what really came out there was the fact that someone had this bright, flashy PR idea. Oh, yeah, we'll have a referendum on International Women's Day and we'll degender women. We'll take mothers out of the Constitution. And right from the start, that was really rankling with me. But there is this whole mood that if you say anything about the degendering agenda, then somehow you're anti-trans, you're anti-progressive, you're anti-equality. I have written columns for the Irish Independent about this and pulled them because I was afraid of the abuse that I was going to get. So I think the piece that I wrote after the referendum was that moment where I realized there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not on anybody's right wing of anything. I'm not a conservative. I actually represent what the vast majority of Irish people think. So it was that moment where I just felt I finally had permission to say what I think. And I think that's why people reacted to it so strongly, because it was giving them permission to say what they think as well. But, you know, it's not just the what we call the woke agenda, because I think, and if you only focus on those progressive ideas, there is this sense that it's conservative. There's been drift on public spending, as I'm sure you guys know. There's been drift on law and order. And that doesn't mean that I want people banged up in jail. I think we need lots more help on drug rehabilitation, on services for the severely mentally ill. You know, we're just failing an awful lot of people. And Fine Gael was not paying attention and was trying to tell us that the problem was in our heads. And people got their say during that referendum.
One of the things that we on this podcast have steered away from is a lot of those issues that you mentioned there, precisely because of the reasons that you mentioned. If we start talking about gender from any perspective, if we start talking about critical race theory, if we start talking about various elements of being, shall we say, progressive these days, we know for sure what's going to happen next. Whatever views we express, from whatever angle, from whatever part of the view spectrum, we're going to get it, and we're going to get it really hard. And we got tired of it, actually. We got bored of it, and it just became thoroughly unpleasant. So I guess really it's not to our credit that we just gave up, that we said, we're just not going to do this anymore because it just isn't fun. It doesn't get us anywhere. Nobody changes their mind. We're just speaking into an echo chamber of people whose views are absolutely solid. Maybe our own are. But do you think that we should be criticized for giving up, Sarah, or do you think that we deserve understanding?
You know, I've been very critical about myself, you know, and feeling like a coward, especially in the case of the puberty blockers for young girls, because that's where real harm has been done. And I think, though, the tide is turning and the NHS has now banned the prescription of puberty blockers for girls, and that clinic in Tavistock has been shut down. But I think in 20 to 30 years, there will be inquiries into how the young girls were treated in precisely the same way we have inquiries now about Magdalene laundries or mother and baby homes. And people will look at us and say, why did you say nothing? And I'm actually getting an insight now into the Ireland of old and why people said nothing. You know, it is hard to speak up when you feel like everyone else is all going the same way. So isn't it interesting how the mechanics haven't changed, you know, even though the issues at hand might have changed? So that is a lesson for us.
Absolutely. Speaking up is important. I mean, this is another one of those areas that Jim and I started to talk about back in October, but quickly gave up because of what happened next in terms of social media and all sorts of different ways people get in touch with us. And that was the Israel-Hamas thing. And I certainly don't want to get into that today. But again, speaking about another great article in the FT, the philosopher, writer, Yuval, I can't pronounce his name, Harari,
the Israeli writer. Yeah he's fantastic.
He wrote a great piece in which the first section was written entirely from the Palestinian perspective. The second section was written entirely from the Israeli perspective. And he made a number of great points. But this is related to people speaking up, in that he said that at the moment, the only people whose voices are being heard, whose voices are actually saying anything are the people on either side of this divide who want to exterminate the other. Mm-hmm. And that all of the people who don't believe the other side should be exterminated are silent or silenced or both. And I think that there is sometimes a moral or ethical imperative on those of us who are in the middle of these debates somewhere, at least not at the extremes, to speak up rather than be cowards. I often think the Northern Ireland situation was a bit like that most people didn't want the other side to be destroyed and were just trying to get on with their lives, but didn't actually speak up enough.
I think it's worth analyzing the mechanics of that, because it applies to a lot of things. It applies to climate change. It applies to, say, reform in the health service. It applies, obviously, to Hamas. And I often remember the model of Nelson Mandela, where he learned to speak Afrikaans, because he said you have to learn the language of your opponent if you're going to, you know, come to any accommodation. So there's been a lot of concern expressed by the government about the rise of the far right and the polarization of politics. But if they're going to label people who are expressing center ground opinions held by normal people as far right opinions, then are they the ones doing the polarization? So back in the column that I wrote in January, which I went back on this morning, you know, Roger Corman was warning about a culture war. And I said, well, if you don't want a culture war, don't start one. You know, like, you decided to have this referendum. People weren't really calling for it. So if I, you know, with Simon Harris now, who has an opportunity to reset things, I would really start getting into listening mode. And there are some urgent things. Obviously, there's housing. But say in terms of the debate and de-escalating the rhetoric, I think a lot could be done on climate and agriculture, which, Jim, obviously, I know is a particular interest of yours, where you've got the IFA talking about the Greens trying to destroy rural Ireland. And, you know, and you have the Greens maybe kind of shaming farmers into thinking that by their mere existence and function of food production, you know, they're wrecking the world. And in fact, I plan this week to write a little bit about that there must be a soft spot there and a comfort zone where farmers can get paid a decent price for their food and the normal population can eat meat three or four times a week instead of twice a day. But that only begins, and that listening exercise and that art of the possible, which politics is supposed to be for, can only start when you de-escalate and you stop shaming people and you stop naming people as being far right or climate deniers. So I think politics has a huge amount to do right now. And I'm really hoping Simon Harris, you know, will jump in and will try and change the tone and let the middle ground speak up and find compromises to all these seemingly insurmountable problems.
Sarah, can I get back to that in a second? The first thing I just like to pick you up on is you mentioned the word progressive earlier on. Mm. I have a very good friend who keeps referring to people he likes as being very progressive. As a term, it really pisses me off, I have to say, because it's the sort of a definition of an Irish liberal is somebody who's open to all ideas as long as they agree with their own ideas. I mean, what do you think this whole what is your definition of progressive?
Jim, I've been thinking about this because when I'm writing my columns, I find my using words like equality and progressive as a pejorative. I don't go, but why am I doing that? Progressive is good. Equality is good. I'm not against any of these things. But the problem is that the people who label themselves as progressive are labeling anyone who disagrees with them as reactionary. So since the referendum, I have been doing various media programs, and every time the presenter of the program frames my no vote to the referendum as evidence of conservative backlash or a Catholic reactionary. I spoke to some other women in the public eye about maybe should we have some kind of common platform for mothers? And they said, but Sarah, if you say mothers too often, people will think you're a Catholic. You know, so, and left and right doesn't mean anything anymore. Like, you'll have the Irish Times journalists constantly accusing Fine Gael of being right wing. But right wing in what sense? If public spending has increased from 68 billion in 2016 to 110 billion in 2024, and we're all social democrats now anyway, none of the labels apply. It's a really, really strange place to be, and a really tough challenge then to try and describe what's going on and try to identify what politics people really do represent when these labels are just also warped.
Yeah, I think I've made the argument several times on this podcast that how you could possibly describe Fine Gael as a right-wing party, I have no idea. You know, if you look at particularly, as you say, on the public spending and taxation side, it certainly is not the behaviour of a party you would classify as right-wing. Simon Harris has taken over. He's about up to a year at most to turn things around for Fine Gael. What do you think the prospects are and what do you think he's going to be like?
Okay, well, the first thing is, you know, alarm bells are going off in my head a bit when people say, oh yeah, he's going to be a good leader because he's a good communicator. And I remember very clearly when Leo Varadkar was elected, that's why they elected him. I wrote a piece in the Sunday Independent at the time where there had been some concern that maybe the Fine Gael members and councillors wouldn't like him as a leader because he was gay. And I said, no, they don't care about that. All they care about is somebody who actually gets on with the media, which he did. People liked him because he was a straight talker. And he said things, you know, that sounded unpopular in the media space, but the people loved. And then once he got the job, he folded and panicked every time he got criticism from the media and was oversensitive to it. So if that's the same reason you elected Simon Harris, then are we looking at that same possibility? So we'll know in the reshuffle. That's how we'll know whether or not he actually means business. So all those negotiations are going on right now. And I believe that he is reaching out to some of the exiting Fine Gael TDs. This is the caucus of up to nearly a dozen TDs now who've said they're not running again at the general election. And can he lure some of them back into the cabinet? And that would show, you know, that he is reversing that trend. Now, the just rumours and text messages I'm getting from people so far, and we're recording this on Tuesday morning, say that some of them have said no, they're just not going back, they're done. But for instance, what will he do with someone like Helen McEntee? And I always feel bad when I criticise Helen McEntee because I'm a Meath woman. I know the McEntee family, it's like a tribe. And you just, you know, they have this fantastic reputation and are idolised in Meath. But she really did drop the ball on a couple of issues. Obviously, you know, telling people that the streets of Dublin were safe. When I'm walking around Dublin city centre and I'm scared all the time in daylight, you know, so you can't tell people that it's safe. She also did a weird one where she delayed the closing of NAV and A&E. So, you know, as you both know, Ireland has far too many critical care units, you know, where we have these A&Es every 20 miles, and all the common sense recommendations for 30 years has been, we cannot keep supporting these A&Es. They're dangerous. People need to be in the big centres for the big cardiac care. You turn your local hospital into a minor injuries unit. We've done it in Roscommon. It really, really works. But she buckled on Navan Hospital when it was the right thing to do, which was a very un-McEntee-like thing to do. So what's he going to do with Helen? And I think if he leaves her in justice, then that shows there's absolutely no change. Does he give her another senior cabinet post? Personally, I would drop her altogether. I know that's hard, but they need women in the cabinet. So maybe give her something like higher education, his own post. But we'll know in the reshuffle whether or not he actually means business or not. And then if he gets his reshuffle right, and I said this in my follow-up piece this Saturday, housing, housing, housing. And I believe housing is the issue from which all other issues flow. So the concern about anti-immigration sentiment, that's an accommodation problem. You know, if you've run out of beds, if people are sleeping in the tents, if you're taking the last hotel in Roscommon, that's housing. Also, as I said, the safety on the streets with drug addicts and the severely mentally ill on the streets, that's a housing issue because you cannot treat people with those conditions unless they have somewhere stable to stay, probably a sheltered kind of accommodation that they really need. So it's all, so, you know, it obviously doesn't cover absolutely everything. But if you can at least show that you're serious about housing and that you really mean it, I think he could turn things around.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Some of our great self-described progressives object to every housing development.
Oh, don't talk to me. I had a pop at Eoin Reardon, you know, at the weekend. You know, why are left-wing people opposing housing? Like, it's unbelievable. Or I was so disappointed once to see Ivana Bacik, whom I know and like she's a good person. And she objected to a build-to-rent scheme in her constituency on the basis that it would bring in a transient population. And I thought, really? So people paying $2,500 a month for an apartment in one of the richest areas in Dublin are now transients? Like, it's just crazy. It really, really
is.
At
the end of the day, Sarah... Yeah. At the end of the day, Sarah, we're all transient.
I lived in rental accommodation until I was married and I had two children. You know?
Absolutely. Like, the thing about the housing is that that we always say on this podcast, we bang on and on about it, and we always get grief for it, is that it's not a problem that is unique to Ireland. It is something that there was a report only yesterday from a think tank over here in the UK called the Resolution Foundation, which was looking at the quality and cost, two dimensions of UK housing in an international context. And it made several points, not unexpectedly, it said that UK housing is very expensive and very poor quality. And actually, on those two dimensions, it is the most expensive and the poorest quality in the world. It is worse from a cost and a quality perspective than you have in Ireland. So if you think you've got a housing crisis, come over here. Or indeed, go to Canada, go to Portugal, go to any of these countries that their media on a daily basis has headlines with the words housing and crisis in them. And it speaks to a more general issue about the solvability of problems. Another great article in the Financial Times, my favorite journal of the moment, written by a writer called Janine Ganesh just the other day, was talked about the unsolvable problems. And I was reminded of this when I was reading Fintan O'Toole's obituary, or political obituary, for Leo Varadkar only yesterday, I think it was yesterday or today, in which he listed all the different health ministers that Ireland has had in recent decades. So from different political parties, very different types, different genders, all these different people have not delivered the health service that Ireland deserves or that Fintan O'Toole actually wants. And it was an extraordinary piece of journalism because it concluded that it was all their fault. All these health ministers had failed abjectly and that, you know, it's just dreadful, isn't it, that Ireland has had such a succession of awful health ministers throughout many, many decades. And, you know, what can you do? It was most unaware in the sense that if you looked at it and without even reading that Ganesh article about the unsolvability of problems, you would look at that list of people and think, maybe they're not all bad. Maybe they're not all completely incompetent. Maybe they're not all effing useless. And that maybe health is, in Ganesh's language, one of those unsolvable problems. And if it's not that bleak, if it's not that bad, maybe it's one of life's really, really hard problems to solve, and maybe it isn't entirely all of their fault. So I thought his comments were poor. I thought it was very poor analysis, if not poor journalism. And more generally, it reminded me that politicians, they get such a bad rap, and I know they deserve it on many different occasions, but nobody ever these days cuts them some slack and acknowledges just how hard a job that they have. And in particular, I think a lot of the political obituaries written about Leo Varadkar, both in Ireland and indeed over here, there was one in the London Times this week, have been very churlish, begrudging, and uncharitable and unkind, to be honest. It's a tough gig, isn't it?
Yeah, it really, really is. And funny enough, on health specifically, I wrote another piece before Christmas where I ended up in a public hospital in Ireland because I was acutely ill. And I was very sick, and I got fantastic care. like really fantastic. I had a team of Pakistani surgeons who I was in Mullingar A&E, which is in the Midlands. And a surgeon raced down from the Mater Hospital because he'd been sent my CT results from Mullingar A&E. And I had surgery in the middle of the night, which was certainly both life-saving and also saved me from, you know, some major outcomes on my general health. And I wrote in that article that my outcome is normal. All you ever hear about from health are the bad cases and the things that go wrong. But actually, the Irish state treats people successfully at huge scale, really, really huge scale, on a daily and weekly basis. And the evidence for how successful the Irish state is in our life expectancy. Like, I think we have, if not the longest life expectancy in the Europe, we're certainly up, you know, in the top range. And that comes from two things. That comes run from a health system, and number two, from wealth, which I'm sure you well know.
Absolutely. If I could interrupt you there, Jim and I have actually done work in many years ago actually on measuring quality of life to the extent that you can. It's an imperfect thing, and you talk about all sorts of things: education, income, diet, your housing quality, if not the quantity of housing. And there are a whole bunch of factors that go into the sort of things. So when people compile quality of life indicators and people debate them, and we can have statistical rows, but there's one that the Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen wrote a book about this. Actually, he said if there's one indicator that captures all of the inputs into anybody's definition of quality of life, it's life expectancy.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Ireland has one of the top life expectancies in the world. And that really is a very strong, powerful statistic that makes a very strong, powerful statement about the quality of life in Ireland.
Yeah.
No, I just want to say that if we say anything positive about Ireland in any sense, the blowback you get from certain people, because it just doesn't fit the narrative.
So that's two things. First of all, that's organized. You know, like that is a Sinn Féin opposition that can mobilize and organize its own people very, very well. So particularly on social media, you know, that they will shout the loudest. And the one thing I would do if I was Simon Harris is just take ministers off Twitter. It serves no purpose. It's a magnet. Like there's a litter bin theory of littering, whereas if you put up a litter bin, you'll actually create littering. Because people won't bring home their litter. They'll just throw it in the bin. And when the bin fills up, throw it around the bin. Twitter's a magnet for abuse. And I would just stop it, you know. But the other one is the mainstream media. It's very, very easy to obviously hang a lot on social media. But when you have somebody like Fintan O'Toole, who is such a powerful and influential journalist, and the guy can write, you know, I'll hand it to him, and about twice a year he'll write a column and I'll go, yep, you're bang on. But it is so corrosive to persuade people all the time that we are living in a failed state when we are clearly not. And that life expectancy is just one indisputable piece of evidence that we're not. But if you bang away and you persuade people that everything is terrible, and not only that everything is terrible, but the government has no interest and doesn't want to make things better, or is so profoundly incompetent it can't make things better, like that simply isn't true. And the problems that we have, as you well know, are problems of demand and capacity, that the recovery from the bailout was just so extraordinary, took everybody by surprise. So we stopped building houses for whatever it was, 5-10 years. And no one saw this recovery coming. So, you know, I hope we will catch up. I know from the contacts that I have with people in the property industry, and say I'll be chairing the Planning Institute conference now in a couple of weeks in Jim's native Waterford, that there is a consensus emerging on how you can build housing. So, for example, they accept that building apartment blocks is just simply economically unviable, and that what you need to do are build these low-rise, own-door houses, you know, that are much more affordable and what more people actually want in terms of how they're going to live. So it is dreadfully slow. But there is a responsibility, I think, on the mainstream media to give credit where it's due, because we can see the result in the political fragmentation. So, you know, we're all talking about Fine Gael. The brand that's going to soar in the next election is not Sinn Féin, it's the independents. And how do you form a government when you're going to have a Dáil full of independents? And And I go back to that moment after the 2016 election where I'm a huge fan of Enda Kenny, but I thought he made a strategic error in handing out cabinet positions too easily to some of the independents who had the balance of power. Because the fact is, if you want to get into cabinet, you're probably better off now running as an independent. And I don't know how they're going to manage that in terms of government formation next time. That's the real challenge. Sinn Féin, the trend seems to be down. They peaked too early. And I think people have seen that a lot of their opposition really is just sloganeering, and they've yet to come up with viable solutions themselves. But that won't solve your independent problem. So government has to make it look like government can work and is effective and not reward independents for being splitters. They really need to reel back in that group who were originally Fine Gael and originally Fianna Fáil and bring them back into the fold. But not at such a reward that it just incentivizes more people to split off. It's a tricky one to manage.
Yes, Sarah, I want to ask you about political participation. I would say on the independence piece, Matt Shanahan, an independent down in Waterford, I think talks more sense generally than every other politician in the Dáil put together. And I just wish there were a lot more people like him in the political process. But Fintan O'Toole, whom I thought had retired a few weeks ago, and alas, his columns keep creeping up, but I never read them, but Chris forces me to read some of them.
I read the headlines, yeah. And then maybe after a couple of days, I'll try and read the column.
But what he said,
it's the single transferable column. Ireland is a dystopian hellhole, and it's everybody else's fault but mine.
But his parting comment about Simon Harris is that he has risen without trace, which is the perfect path to power in contemporary Irish politics. With that sort of vitriol, and that's mild compared to most of the stuff politicians get, what does it say about the future of political participation? Why would anybody with a semblance of ability, sense, skill, whatever, get involved in politics at this juncture?
Yeah, like the abuse is terrible. Like, it really is. And as I said, and as you've just demonstrated, it's not just from social media. It's a mainstream media issue too, where they simply will not give any credit. But here's the reason. So a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Francis Fitzgerald, who's retiring as an MEP, for a podcast for the European Parliament. And I put the point to her about NGOs. You know, there's a lot of resentment about the power and the funding from the government that NGOs have to lobby the government to implement the agenda that they want. And I said, look, where does power lie? And she said, and she's right, look, at the end of the day, power does lie in cabinet. That is where you actually can make decisions and can change things. And she was able to list some of her own achievements. And ultimately, that is why people do want to get in. It's the minister decides. What I don't understand is why then ministers constantly seek to outsource their power and disenfranchise themselves. So the most striking example of that, for instance, is the Citizens' Assembly, where they said, oh, we had to have this referendum because the Citizens' Assembly recommended it be so, even though the DCU political scientist, Owen O'Malley, as he outlined in his column in the Sunday Independent recently, showed the evidence that the Citizens' Assemblies are highly suggestible. You know, you set one up for the particular goal in mind, you bring in the experts, he'll slant them in a particular way, and voila, the recommendation is produced. But if you're a legislator, if you're a politician, if it's your job, you know, to introduce legislation, why do you go around saying, oh, well, I'm just doing this because a highly paid focus group, told me to do this instead? So, or outsourcing of decisions to public sector agencies because they don't want to get blamed for decisions around infrastructure. So if power is the reason that you're there, why keep trying to escape your responsibilities and persuade people that actually you don't have power over that at all? So, and yet the power and the executive responsibility does lie there. So that's the reason, Jim, the answer, power. Do you want power or not? And if you want power to change, then you have to get into politics and you have to get into cabinet. And the challenge for the political parties is, why is Matt Shanahan an independent? You know, why did he not feel that he could express his views and get recognition for that and get promoted within government by expressing those views? Why is it this bubble that, well, you're kind of in the Leo gang or whatever the gang du jour is, and then if you don't toe that line, then that's it, you're out? And so many people have said to me, where are all the characters in politics gone? Like, there used to be brilliant characters who, you know, could say stuff and be funny and be entertaining and be forthright, and now they're terrified to say anything. So if I was Simon Harris, I'd be ringing up someone like Matt Shanahan and saying, I'll give you a job, but you have to join Fine Gael first. You know, that's the price.
Now, Matt, if you're listening.
Take the call. Now's the moment to strike. Take the call.
Jim, Sarah, we could do this all day, and I hope you come back soon, Sarah, to continue the conversation. But in the interests of your time, I think we should call it there and just finish up me anyway, saying thank you so much for a fantastic conversation. Thanks for your time. And I know that lots of people are going to find that very, very interesting. And I think it is a voice not from the extremes, which as we both said, the three of us said at various points in this podcast, badly needed. So thanks very much indeed.
Yeah, well, Sarah, might be happy. I'd like to thank you very much as well. Fascinating discussion. But before I let you off the hook, I want to ask you one question.
Yes.
Who do you think will form the next government?
Well, the trick, the challenge for Fine Gael is, can they or should they be persuaded to go into opposition? Or will they accept the premise of the argument that under no circumstances whatsoever must Sinn Féin be allowed in? Now, if you're Micheál Martin, you want to put pressure on Fine Gael to go in and be part of the next government because you don't want to be in with Sinn Féin. Because a small Fianna Fáil party in with a larger Sinn Féin party means Micheál Martin doesn't get to be Taoiseach. If you're looking at the long-term interests of Fine Gael, you should go into opposition because every year they stay in government is an extra year of losing seats and having to get the blame for problems that aren't solved. I used to abhor the idea of Sinn Féin going in and that it was Fine Gael's moral duty to go in and stop them getting in. But I don't know how long you can keep that up, how you can maintain that. At some point, Fine Gael have to get out of government. And at some point,
Sinn Féin have the last
time. Yeah. So that is the real challenge. And the problem is that if you have senior cabinet members who want to stay in cabinet and be ministers rather than thinking about the long-term prospects of Fine Gael, that's a very tight conversation to have and one that Simon Harris would come under huge pressure to answer in the next year. So I'd have a whole team sitting down working out the strategy on how you answer that question. That one question has to be answered. So I'd have team A on that. So that's not much of an answer, Jim, but that's what I'd be doing anyway.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Talk again.
Okay, thanks, Jim and Chris, for having me. Huge pleasure. And I love the show. I'm a big fan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.